Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. The reading that we had this morning at breakfast time, reading from some of Ajahn Chah's teachings, was very useful and pertinent reflection. Those of you who've been staying here, living here, will recollect that Ajahn Chah was talking about the favored, one of his favored themes, as he said, you know, I've been saying this over and over again for decades, and about impermanence. What does Ajahn Chah teach? Oh, he just talks about impermanence, saying how people hear him saying the same old thing over and over again, so they get tired and bored, or they don't bother to show up. But yet, also indicating illuminating how this is such a central teaching. This is like the essential gateway to liberation. To really understand and to know anicca, to truly take that to heart, to allow that to enter the heart. In the Thai language, to understand is Khao Chai, which literally means to enter the heart, to allow, to really understand anicca, to allow anicca really to enter the heart, to be truly known, then that is synonymous with the realization of the breakthrough to stream entry, that to truly know anicca. Is once that is truly known, then enlightenment is inevitable. That there is no turning back at that point, if we really understand anicca. And so, as in the suttas, over and over again, when someone arrives at stream entry, then that insight is defined in terms of person knew yankinchi samudaya dhammang sabantang niroda damanti. Whatever is subject to arising is also subject to cessation. So intellectually, it's incredibly simple. And also Ajahn Chah could understand why people hearing this over and over again would think, well, so what? What goes up must come down. Big deal. Yeah. Whatever is born dies. Well, that's not difficult to figure out. Even a three-year-old can comprehend that. So it's a conundrum, a puzzle, isn't it? It's such a simple concept, but yet it's so crucial to our liberation. It's so crucial to the fulfillment of the aspirations that we have all formed in coming to this place, whether it's for a day, for a week, for a year, or for a lifetime. As he was recounting in that talk that we heard this morning, he was almost bemoaning the fact, I say this over and over again, been talking about this for decades, but still, you know, people don't really understand. They don't really allow it in. They keep trying to hang on to keep things that they want to own, and then they're surprised when they dissolve and disappear, or they keep fretting about things that they feel are burdening them, and then they're surprised when they when those burdens evaporate. They're not as they're not as permanent or eternal as they feared. We keep being surprised by the way that things change. It should be no surprise. Over and over again, when people come to visit. Just, you know, today there was a family that came young person who's been diagnosed with and treated for cancer, and the difficulties and stresses, the challenges of being faced with that actuality, that diagnosis. And then, as I often do, I said to her and her parents, well, none of us are going to get out of this alive. Everyone in this hall, in this sala, we're all, every single one of us is going to pass away. Even these young kids who came today, they're not that old, but it's the same for them too. And as you say those words, you can, there's within the people who are listening, you can see there's a, what? How can that be? And just like as I'm saying these words now, you think, well, that's for the people who are in the sala. But, you know, something in us has a strange logic that assumes, well, somehow that's not really applying to me, or that's some other place, some other time, somewhere else. And as Ajahn Chah said, it's always over there. Death is always over there. Change is always over there. Some other place, some other time, some other people. It's there. It's never truly recognized as being here. So, you know, this is a tragicomic. If it wasn't so tragic, it would be laughable how we keep missing it, how we keep missing the point in this way. And the two aspects of anicca that he referred to there, and which I also like to highlight and to describe, because they're very significant, different angles of approach, are that oftentimes we think of anicca almost as a physical quality in terms of an object, whether it's a this building, whether it's the planet, whether it's our bodies, whether it's a thought. We think of anicca as referring to the physical quality of change, or the natural quality of impermanence, change. So in a way it's an attribute of the objective world. Things change, even if it's a thing that's happening or known internally, like an emotion, a sensation in the body, a thought in the mind, that we relate to anicca as that thing, that object is changing. So it's almost a physical, mechanical quality. But Ajahn Chah, more often than not, rather than focusing upon that quality of anicca, just referring to the object, the objective realm, he tended more to emphasize it in terms of the subject, how the heart reacts to the experience of things changing. When a thought changes, an emotion changes, a relationship changes, the body changes, the world changes. And the way that's received on the side of the subject, the way that is known or felt, on the subject side of the equation, is with the quality of uncertainty. So he used these terms as a pair, maitiang as impermanent, but mainer means uncertain. That is changing, maitiang. It's not stable. It's not fixed. But the mainer means it's uncertain, it's not a sure thing. And that latter aspect of it was what he focused on, because that's how we feel, that's where we create suffering and happiness, is around the realm of feeling. And that feeling, the way that the quality of uncertainty impacts the heart, the quality of change impacts the heart, is that it generates this feeling of uncertainty. We don't know what this thing is going to change into. So it brings about a quality of instability in the heart, quality of doubt. So to me, in working with the developing the perception of anicca in meditation, using that as a tool for the development of insight, for freeing the heart, then using this attribute of uncertainty, I find for myself in a way far more directly effective and potent tool for loosening the habits of self-view and those habits of feeling that we can keep the pleasant or that we are burdened by the painful, and that that those habits of attachment and identification. That uncertainty is in a way the key to unraveling that. Now, in particular, the reflections on anicca, also anicca, dukkha, and anatta, on uncertainty, on unsatisfactoriness, on not self. These are relating to the way that we habitually hold the five khandhas, the five groups of the physical and mental world, the five different divisions, the sort of rough clumping of our experience, the physical realm, rupa khanda, the form group, the form heap. That is our physical form, this body, also the form of the material world, other beings, buildings, the planet, the trees, the mountains, the rivers. This is all rupa khanda. The physical universe is rupa khanda, the form collection, the form aggregate. That chunk of our experience that is related to the material world. So then the other four are what are called the namakandas, or the mental groups, the mental aggregates or collections. These are perception, feeling, mental formations, and consciousness. Vedana, physical sensation, pleasant, painful, or neutral feeling. Perception, sanya, being the perception of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. Sankhara is a broad term, but in this respect it means the mental activity, thoughts, emotions, memories, plans, moods, that whole domain of mental formations, you know, that which we say is mental activity, things generated internally in the mind. And then vijnana, consciousness, the very fabric of cognizing itself, the capacity of the mind to know, to distinguish this from that, to discriminate one object from another, to know a knowable object, vijnana, sense consciousness, or discriminative consciousness. So these are the five khandhas. We're all, probably most of us, very familiar with all of these terms. But this is basically the body and the mind, the physical realm and the mental realm, the material realm and the non-material realm of mind, thoughts and feelings. So it's because we don't see these as uncertain, because we try to habitually find certainty and stability in the material world, in our possessions, in our moods and feelings, our quality of clarity of mind or of happiness, physical comfort. And then we're continually surprised when suddenly we get an illness and we're not comfortable, when our nose is running or our eyes are itchy from the pollen, or someone that we love falls out with us and that relationship is strained or broken, then we're surprised, or we're stressed. Oh dear, I didn't expect this, or it shouldn't happen this way. So the Buddha pointed to the habits of these very habits of the of attachment, identification with the five khandhas, with the body and the mind, these aspects of our physical and mental worlds, to say, look at that, look at these. Isn't it amazing how we keep thinking of these as being substantial, as being, you know, solid, as being absolutely real? Our body, you know, continually changing, every breath changes the body. We're continually acquiring new material, losing material, shedding skin cells. You know, Venerable Santamano comes to my kuti, clears, sweeps up all the dust diligently every day. All the windowsills and the floor, and all that dust is, well, some of it must be long pores, but most of it is just the skin cells that I've shed just during the course of a day. So I appreciate him sweeping them up and disposing of them in the bin. And but that's the body changing, isn't it? All the food that we are generously offered and provided with in the kitchen, prepared lovingly and offered with great generosity and kindness. Every day we ingest pounds and pounds of it. We acquire this. The body's changing. And that which is now the food store or the fridge, that which is now in Safeways or Waitrose, is soon will be us, be you, be me. And then it won't be you and me anymore. It'll move on to being the dust on my floor that the Venerable Santamano has to sweep up, or contributing to the sewage plant in Great Gadsden, merging with the earth and the streams, the air. So the Buddha pointed to the five khandhas and said, look at these. Isn't it amazing how we take these to be solid and real and permanent, when all the evidence, when we look, is telling us no, these are not substantial. Well, one of my favorite teachings on this is the in the Sanyutta Nikaya, the Connected Discourses. It's called the lump of foam, and the Buddha makes these five very clear similes to help reflect on this. The insubstantiality of the body and mind. So if you see on the river Ganges, floating on the surface of the river, he was staying in a place by the river Ganges at that time, Ayodhya. So if you see this big lump of foam floating on the surface of the water, do you think that has any solidity? Is it substantial? Has it got any kind of permanent structure? Permanent form? I said, well, no, it's just a lump of foam. It's insubstantial. It's hollow. It's void. He said, so too, this body, the all material form is exactly the same. It's hollow. It's void. It's empty of substance. It is insubstantial. So how could it have any permanent and absolute existence? It's in a state of change. It's in a continual mutates, transforms in a continual pattern of transformation, continual pattern of change. How could it have any permanent and absolute substance? So the body is like a lump of foam, rupa, like a lump of foam. Vedana, feeling. He compared to in the rainy season, when the rain falls down onto a pool of water and the raindrops hit the surface, then for a moment they will make a bubble, like a hemispherical shape. The raindrop hits the water and forms a brief round bubble, and then before you know it, that bubble is dissolved and merged with the surface of the pool once again. And he said, the feeling is like a water bubble. Yeah, it's just a mere shape, an insubstantial form. It's there for a moment and then it's gone. It has no substance, no form. It is hollow, it's void. Yeah, how could it have any permanent reality, permanent substance? The feeling is like a water bubble. And perception, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, perception, he compared to a mirage, traveling through the desert, seeing the shape of a town or an oasis, some forms that you think are close by, but it's actually just a trick of the light, that those forms are not there at all, that those palm trees, those buildings, they're not really there, they're just apparently present, but it's just a trick of the light. So perceptions are empty, hollow, insubstantial, like a mirage. Sankhara, the mental formations, are emotions, those precious and wonderful, valuable emotions. Things that we dread, things that we love, things that we are pulled around by. Feelings of attraction, feelings of aversion, feelings of excitement, feelings of irritation, feelings of inspiration, feelings of despair. You know, sankhara is just a short word, but it comprises our whole emotional realm, the realm of concepts, ideas, information, memory, plans, motivation. There's a huge range of stuff packaged inside that one word. But this the Buddha compared to the trunk of a banana tree, a plantain, which like a leek or an onion, you peel away the leaves, and he says you peel away leaf after leaf looking for the heartwood, looking for the core, but when you get there you can't find a core. There isn't any heartwood, there isn't any center. There's just leaf upon leaf upon leaf. There's no heartwood, there's no solid presence there at the very center. And then lastly, consciousness, vijnana, he compared to a conjuring trick, that when you watch a conjurer performing a disappearance, making some object disappear or making it reappear, it looks like that's really happening, like this, you throw up a curtain and boom, the elephant vanishes, or you take your hat off and out comes the rabbit. All kinds of wonderful and amazing things happen at the hands of a conjurer, but it's just a trick. Those things aren't really happening. The elephant isn't really evaporating. The rabbit isn't suddenly manifesting from an empty hat. It's just a trick of the skill of the conjurer. The sleight of hand, the quickness of the hand and the eye being deceived. So these are our images that the Buddha put forth to help us to cultivate the anicca sanya, to truly, in a way, prize apart our grip, that the habits of clinging to what we want to hang on to, that we want to keep, we want to own, to see. These are not ours. These can't be held, they're changing. To break the illusion that the things that we love or cherish or think that we own are really ours or are really permanent or really can be kept, really can be, stored away and be a part of who and what we are and our things, our stuff, the fabric of our true life. Well, I find these images very helpful and give, a direct support to that quality of prizing open the grip, like the hand sort of fiercely sort of grasping the object, that just, you know, these images and the reflections on the clinging to the five khandhas and the emptiness of the five khandhas. See how pointless that is, that just like trying to own a water bubble or own a mirage, trying to permanently keep a piece of foam or to be permanently, say, convinced of a trick of the hand. It's not going to work. It's ridiculous. It's an absurdity. And that's what the Buddha was trying to do. He's saying, look, it's absurd what we're doing, how we function. This is Ajahn Chah was saying the same thing in the talk this morning. Isn't it absurd how we do this? It's amazing. How strange. So that the effort that we need to make is going against that current, that the habits of clinging, which are, as we know, tremendously powerful, and to be consciously developing the anicca sanya, this perception of uncertainty, the perception that things are not the way that we seem, things are not fixed, things are not locked into one particular form or reality. And the signals, so that's the case, are around us everywhere. You know, that we every single thing in the mental and physical world is in the state of change. So the messages are there constantly and repeated to us over and over again, just like Ajahn Chah endlessly pursuing the subject. The messages of anicca are everywhere. But it takes the effort within us to rise up and say, oh look, that's changing. Oh look, that's there's anicca. Coming into a room, leaving a room, day changing into night, night changing into day, blue skies turning to rain, rain turning to blue skies, the bare branches of a tree bursting into leaf, then in the autumn the leaves changing again. Or just like yesterday we had the ordination for Sister Kemaka. So one more Sila Dara comes into the world, change. Rupa has gone, no more Rupa in white, no more anxieties about beetroot and tomato puree. Dark brown robes hide a multitude of sins, accidents in the kitchen. So there's a change. You know, one more nun comes into the community. Earlier in the week, Ajahn Ananda Bodhi, Ajahn Santajita took leave of the community of Sila Dara. So, two stepped out, one stepped in. It's change, it's impermanence. So just to be seeing that, oh look, you know, now that Sister Kemaka, now her manifestation in the world is in brown robes, not white. It's change. And now these other two nuns have gone off to start their new venture. It's change. But also to reflect on uncertainty. You know, how do we, not just in uncertainty in terms of how are things going to turn out, but also our attitudes. You know, we are very prone in our life to create particular habits of perception, things that we like, things that we dislike, things that we approve of, things that we disapprove of, our pet peeves, things that we love to disapprove of, that we like to get annoyed about, things that we regard as good and beautiful, things that we regard as unworthy or ugly. Part of the development of anicca sanya is learning to look at our own opinions and judgments, our own aspirations, our own hopes, to say, well, how will it turn out? Don't know. This is the answer. Yeah. Is there are very mixed feelings about the two sisters leaving the order of Sila Dara and choosing to set up their vihara in San Francisco as taking bhikkhuni ordination. There's very mixed feelings. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? This is a prime opportunity to cultivate the anicca sanya. It's not a sure thing. So, and for many people, even within themselves, within individuals, they're both positive and negative feelings. Something is inspired, something is concerned. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? What we can know for sure is that it's uncertain. It's not a fixed thing. It's not a sure thing. Is it a good idea to be talking about this from the Dhamma seat? Not a sure thing. Is it good? Is it bad? My nair. It's not a sure thing. It's uncertain. So this is a wonderfully powerful tool, Because just like we relate in a matter-of-fact way to, say, feeling of health, we're glad about that. When we're sick, then we're unhappy about that. Very inconvenient, our nose is running, we've got a headache. We are kind of coughing and sneezing just when we don't want to. It's very natural and automatic to make judgments, but to be able to take that step back to see things from that reflective position, to say, it's not certain. Is this a good thing or is it bad? Not a sure thing. This is, I was saying to the young person today who had received this cancer diagnosis and is being treated for that, that she didn't seem terribly convinced, but I was explaining how, as I often say, and many of you have heard me say over and over, sometimes the very things that we would never have asked for, that we would consider to be the most painful difficulties, illnesses or losses in our life, they've brought about the most wonderful blessings. They've brought the greatest changes and gifts. The things that were the most challenging that you would never ask for can bring the greatest blessings. Just as Venerable Sila Vimala at the ordination yesterday was pointing out or bringing up the tragic death of Sister Kemaka's son, when he was just in his early 20s, that the painfulness of that loss then brought about a change of perspective in her, a change of a view on the world, to where she decided to leave the household life and enter the order of nuns. And so that it's that kind of loss, that kind of grief and sadness, many of us, all of us probably have some similar things. It's a painfulness, a difficulty, a challenge we would never ask for if we're given a choice. We'd never say, oh yes please, can I have a fatal illness? You know, yes please, can I be rejected by those who I love? We'd never ask for that. But when it happens, and then when we meet it in a skillful way, when the heart receives that dukkha, when dukkha is understood, when we allow it to enter the heart and to be known, then that understanding of dukkha and rising up to meet it, to know it, can bring about a maturation within us, a deepening of understanding, and also, again, the prizing apart our fingers of the clinging so fiercely to that as an object that helps to challenge our habits of attachment, identification, and that helps us to grow up, to let go of those things that we're trying to keep and own, that we have cherished and have thought were permanent and stable. And it's instead, those painful experiences can say, no, this too, this is not yours. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. And that's you, that's me. That's our stuff, you know, our thinking faculties, our physical comfort, the objects of devotion and love, our... all the whole array, all the things that we know, all of it will become otherwise. How can it not? This is not news. this is not a secret being revealed. And just as we are, say, sometimes challenged by that idea, or feeling this is demanding. When it's followed through, when we allow that quality of uncertainty into the heart to really know it, when we allow the dukkha of disappointment, of grief, or of the feeling of things being out of joint, things being having gone wrong, or being unfair or unjust, things being broken. We allow that into the heart and to truly know that feeling, and then it changes. There's a miraculous change, that dukkha becomes a cause for faith, that discourse of the Buddhas, he says, dukkha becomes a cause for the arising of faith. And it's faith that there must be something beyond this. There is a capacity in this heart to know this and to be free of this. This dukkha is not the whole story. This dukkha is just a feeling. It's just a sankhara. It too, just like the rest of the leaves on the plantain trunk, is just another empty, hollow, insubstantial feeling. How can it not be? There has to be a quality of being other than this. So that faith that dukkha is not the whole story, dukkha is not the absolute reality, this broken feeling, this sense of an unrequited love or an irreparable loss, or this terrible regret, whatever it might be within us, that it can't be an absolute reality. It has no substance, it has no core, it has no essence. And this is what these teachings were pointing to and are so potent and powerful in addressing. How could there be any substance to any of these things? Oh, when we cultivate that quality of the anicca sanya, the perception of uncertainty, then it's in a sense helping us to take a step back, to begin to see that emptiness, the transparency of all formations, all our experience, the mental, the physical world. It's rousing that sense of curiosity, of loosening our grip on our judgments, our opinions, our fears, our hopes, and just seeing and allowing us to see the space around it, to see the space within it, these feelings, these thoughts, these judgments, these opinions, these objects that seem so solid and substantial. We see, oh, it's actually transparent. It's actually just an empty shape. There's no there's nothing solid or absolute in there. Now the Buddha also talked about the five khandhas, saying these are the body is an affliction, is a calamity, is a tumor, it's like a poisoned arrow. It's something that's burdensome and difficult. Not as an absolute reality, but because if we take it to be real, then it acquires those qualities. If we take it to be solid and who and what we are, then it takes on those qualities. So this is helpful to then to consider when we're reflecting on the body, the mind, to see that all of these are really empty of substance, empty of form, empty of any kind of essence. And that in a way that all the things that we think are true, like our name, our personality, our nationality, our opinions and beliefs, these are all basically fake. There's nothing that's absolutely true and real in what they say. Yeah. The body is a calamity if we think it's supposed to be permanent. If we think our ideas are beautiful and true and good, that our beliefs are all correct, then it's a calamity. It's a disease, because it's not the truth of the situation. So this is a helpful way to reflect on all the forms that of perception and feeling, the ideas that we experience, to realize, well, these are none of these are really true. That the body has got a kind of false or fake solidity. It looks solid and it looks kind of like there's it's really there. But then when you get out the electron microscope and take a close look, then you realize there's no absolute substance there. So so something in us searches for validity for that which is real. You know, we want to have something to depend on. This is why we take out insurance policies. This is why we like to hang on to opinions and beliefs. Why we identify with forms and structures and all of the 10,000 things the mind clings on to. We're looking for certainty. We're looking for substantiality. But the problem is that we always are seeking for that in the places where we can't find it. So it's useful to consider, you know, what is validity? What is real? Where can we find that which is substantial or reliable? And also to consider what is valid, what is in a thought, in a word. All words are approximations. All concepts can only be an approximation. Like the Buddha also said about concepts, the conceiving mind, manyati. He says conceiving, again, is a dart, is a tumor, is a calamity, is impermanent, and so forth. That was also subject to the same string of descriptions. Conceiving is a tumor. Conceiving is a dart, a poisoned arrow. Conceiving is a calamity, if we take it to be true. So when we are working in this way, cultivating that perception of anicca, then in a way it's what we're trying to do is to see the fake nature of our thoughts, our feelings, our words, our beliefs, and to see this none of this can be really true or solid. The conventions that we live with, the customs that we have, these can't be absolutely good and right. They're just empty forms. So the point of this reflection that the Buddha offers and stressed so much by Lumpo Cha in his teachings is again just to loosen that grip, loosen that kind of habitual ascribing of substantiality to that which is insubstantial, ascribing validity to that which can't be absolutely valid. So to consider that all my words are lies, well, these half truths. All these thoughts are delusory. This can't be the whole truth. Or it's like Lumpo Somedo once famously said, all your thoughts are garbage. And that doesn't mean to say that every concept is inaccurate in its the information that it carries, or that that we are deliberately trying to deceive. But using this kind of reflection is just helping to bring a perspective on that which takes my words to be absolutely true, to be perfectly representing the actuality, that the concepts that arise in my mind are absolutely accurate, genuine representations of reality, that the feelings that we have, that happiness is absolutely and perfectly pleasing, and that sorrow and sadness, sorrow and pain, regret is an absolutely wrong and burdensome reality. It's cultivating the vision of transparency, that is seeing the true emptiness of things. That if it's formed in any way, mental or physical, it's empty. It's transparent. And when we see, when we acknowledge that transparency, then in that very moment, to that extent, the heart is freed. That seeing that our judgment, our perception, our point of view, our description can only be a half-truth, can only be a working hypothesis. It's a, as I like to say, it's a convenient fiction. Then, when we hold it in that way, then we are getting closer to seeing with the eye of Dhamma. We're getting closer to the heart truly apprehending life as it actually is, and not just forcing it into the mold of our conditioned viewpoint. I should also say, along with emptiness, the partner of sunyata is tatata. And so sunyata, or shunyata in Sanskrit, sunyata in Pali, emptiness is very often spoken of. And in a way, it's a saying no to everything. If it's a thing, you say no to it. No, you're not real. No, there's nothing there. No, this is just empty. No, you're just a soap. You're just a soap bubble. You're just a mirage. You're just a conjuring trick. There's nothing. There's no thing there. There is no thing there. So, cultivating that perception of emptiness is, in a way, saying no to everything. And so that might be a bit sort of challenging and difficult in some ways, even though I would suggest, and most of us would probably recognize, that it's a very accurate way of perceiving and relating to the world. But the partner of emptiness is tatata, which means suchness or thusness, as isness. And that in a way is saying yes to everything, because even though every perception, every feeling, every sankhara, every form is empty of self and that which belongs to a self, it's still of the nature of reality. It's still of the attributes of the way things are, of the Dhamma itself. And so, in a sense, we let go as we use the perception of anicca, the perception of uncertainty to prize our grip open to let things go. It doesn't mean to say that we're negating everything, but that seeing everything in perspective, seeing everything in the eye of Dhamma, then in a way also you're recognizing their essential reality, which is that they are patterns of nature being known through the faculty of awareness, of wisdom, here and now. That which knows things truly and with validity is the panya chaku, the eye of wisdom. So we're cultivating that, learning how to see with this eye of wisdom, the unbiased eye of wisdom, seeing things truly. And so then things are seen in that way, then along with seeing their emptiness, we're also able to see, to feel and to know their suchness. How many times Lumpur Sumedho has said, you know, it's this way, this is the way it is, that this, not to get too complicated, but that this, as in this is the way it is, this is the way things are, that this is referring to suchness, to tatata, this as-isness, that fundamental quality of presence and actuality that all of our experience possesses. So if we cling to suchness, then the mind inclines towards eternalism. If we cling to emptiness, then it inclines towards nihilism. But in a sense that when we are cultivating this quality of wisdom, when the eye of wisdom is open, when the panya chaku, the eye of wisdom, is truly established and seeing clearly, then both of those attributes, the attribute of suchness and the attribute of emptiness. They're both recognized at the same time, like the left eye and the right eye seeing together, and with them then we are blessed with three-dimensional vision. We see the world clearly and in three dimensions. So similarly, seeing the suchness of things and seeing the emptiness of things brings an equivalent 3D representation of reality. We see the true nature of things here and now. Now, when we see things clearly in this way, then that changes the way we relate. So rather than just because a thought, we say, well, all my thoughts are garbage, you know, all my words are lies, you know, food is poison. You know, we can feel like this sense of, well, everything's wrong, everything's fake, everything's insubstantial. And then if we grasp that, it can be feel very depressing or pointless, or the mind drifts to a nihilistic perspective. But if we cultivate this two-eyed approach, this two-eyed perception of the world, then what we find we begin to be able to do is we learn to use the forms of our feelings, our ideas, the conventions that we live with, like Theravada Buddhism, or being a woman, being a man, being a monastic, being a layperson, you know, all these different aspects of our own particular little realm. We are able to use these without confusion. Just as the Buddha, when someone challenged the Buddha, say, you know, Venerable Sir, you say all Dhammas are not self, but how come you're using all these words like I and you and he and she and they and we? You know, what's it with all these personal pronouns if all Dhammas are not self? You know, you're confusing me. Either when you say you and they and she and he, how can you be using those words if everything is not self? And the Buddha said, it's true that all Dhammas are not self, but and I see that the Tathagata sees that clearly. But in order to communicate, he uses the conventions of common speech in order to communicate, in order to express things in a clear and unequivocal way. So this is a very important principle, and so that this is a way that we use the limited and empty qualities of the material world and the conventional world. We employ that, those forms, even though they are insubstantial and empty. We employ those to see that which is beyond the realm of form. We employ the conditioned in order to awaken to the unconditioned. And this is something that's truly miraculous. The Buddha said there are two kinds of miracle: the miracle of psychic power and the miracle of instruction. And of these two, the greatest is the miracle of instruction. That means through these words, which are imperfect, inaccurate, not perfectly understood. English is not the first language of many people here. Also, the sound system in the temple is not great, so the people who are hard of hearing have to kind of cup their ears to catch a reasonable percentage of what's being said. And what I think I'm saying is probably not what many of you think you're hearing. But the amazing thing is that even so, these imperfect and not totally accurate noises can bring about a change in the heart, can bring about an actual substantial change of vision that is real. And one of the reasons why the name Kemaka came to me as a good name for our new Siladhara was one of these the suttas of the Buddha that I'm particularly fond of tells the story of this elder bhikkhu called Kemaka, and he was suffering and gravely ill, and he was living in Kosambi in the Jujube grove in Kosambi in the Gosita Rama. So he was very ill and sick and wretched, and then this group of other elders, elder monks who were living in the monastery, asked one of the monks, Dasaka, to go and visit Venerable Kemaka to see how he was doing. And he went and saw him and said, "How are you doing, Venerable Sir? Is your illness decreasing? Are your pains disappearing?" He said, "No, my illness is getting worse. My pains are increasing. You know, I'm not comfortable at all. I'm suffering and gravely ill." So then this long piece of the sutta where Dasaka goes back to the others and tells them that Kemaka is not doing well. And they say, "Well, go and ask Kemaka whether he has seen that all the five khandhas are not self, and see how, if he's getting to the end of his life, whether he's completed his practice yet, and he's sort of reached arahantship." So then Dasaka goes back, and Venerable Kemaka gives him an answer, and then he goes back to the elders, and then Dasaka comes back again, and they've got some more questions they want to ask him. They go back and forth several times, and finally Kemaka says, "I've had enough of this, all this going back and forth," and hauls himself off his deathbed, gets his walking stick and hobbles over to where all the other group of elders are gathered, and then engages in this dialogue, this wonderful dialogue. And what they've been asking him about was, because they said, well, when they asked him, "Have you seen that the five khandhas are not self?" He has said, "Yes, I see that the realm of form, of feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness, I truly see these are not me, these are not mine, these are not what I am." And they said, "Well, so then you are an arahant." He said, "No, because even though I see these are not self, still there is a feeling of I am that lingers around. Even though it doesn't seem to be attached to any one particular aspect of the body and the mind, it still lingers there." And he says, just as with a flower, a blue, a red, or a white lotus, the lotus flower has a fragrance. You can't say that whether the fragrance comes from the petals or from the stem or from the pistils, but you can see that the flower has fragrance. So in the same way, even though I can't pin it down to any one thing in relationship to the khandhas, still there is this feeling of I am that hovers around, like the scent of a flower, that it's still lingering there, it still remains, even though you can't ascribe it to any one thing. And then he gives another example, or just like as someone who's doing the laundry, that they send off their cloth to the laundry, and then at the laundry it's washed down by the river with soap or lye or some other cleaning agent, that when the cloth comes back and it's beautifully clean, spotless and fresh, still when you receive the cloth you can smell the scent of the soap or the lye or the cleaning agent. It still lingers around the cloth. In the same way, even though the cloth is perfectly clean, still there's a lingering aroma of how it was cleaned. It's in the same way, this feeling of I and me and mine lingers around in my life, even though I know that there's no attachment to the body and feelings and perceptions and so forth. So as Kemaka's giving this discourse, then the other elders, the 60 elders that are gathered there, they said, "Well, we're terribly sorry that we dragged you from your bed to come through this, and give us this explanation. And it wasn't because we were trying to give you, to make life difficult for you, but we're really grateful and we really rejoice in this description that you've given." And then it says at the end, and at the end of this discourse, the minds of those 60 elders were liberated from all suffering, and so was the mind of the Venerable Kemaka. So he is unique in being enlightened by his own Dhamma talk. So I think this might be the only time in the suttas that actually happens, but it was a very a beautiful exchange and a wonderful teaching. And also it demonstrates that miracle of instruction, that even if it's you yourself that are giving the instructions, description was being given, then the elder Kemaka understood in a unique way and with a depth that he hadn't known before how that whole thing worked, and then that that explanation, that explaining, and that reflection upon that area. And as he was expounding it to his fellow monastics, then that was the catalyst that helped him to make the final breakthrough to arahantship. So I thought that was a very a beautiful example of this principle of the miracle of instruction. These flawed minds, these convenient fictions that we live with, our words, our concepts, our these aging, ailing, wrinkled bodies with all of their limitations and ailments, that is this these very ordinary, empty, insubstantial aspects of the material and mental world, through the skillful use of them, through the skillful application of the conditioned, we can awaken to the unconditioned. The unconditioned can be realized. And that is the real miracle. That's the great miracle. So in that way, regarding the five khandhas as empty, as a calamity, as insubstantial, as hollow, is not belittling them, but more seeing them in their true light, and the development of the anicca sanya, the perception of impermanence, is really what is trying to help us to see, to know the five khandhas in their true light, to see them as they truly are. And so then we learn to use our actions, our speech, our ways of relating, the verbal forms that we use to communicate with each other, but also the aspects of ritual, joining together for puja, the customs that we have within this tradition, that they may be insubstantial and formulaic in many ways. We chant the same words over and over again. Many of our ceremonies it's been the same for 2,500 years. But if they are understood, they're held in the right way, then they can bring about a real change in the heart, a change that is substantial, a change that is genuine. And that similarly is a miracle. It's a miraculous thing that just by applying these forms, these structures, these empty and insubstantial patterns in a skillful way, they bring about genuine transformations of the heart. So similarly, just as, say, going back to the sisters who from the Vihara in America, as they took their leave from the order of Siladhara and the order of bhikkhus, then we closed their time as Siladhara with a ceremony of asking for forgiveness. And this is a ceremony all of us in this community have done dozens of times. Say, Acharya Pamadena, I ask forgiveness to the elder or the teacher, to my sisters, for whatever has been done by body, speech, or mind, intentionally or unintentionally, that has been hurtful to you or painful in any way. For that, I ask for your forgiveness. You open yourself up, you recognize that your actions, no matter how well intended, might have been hurtful to others. And then the person who's being asked then always responds, Ahang kamami tumehi me kamitabang. I forgive you and please forgive me also. So even if the person that you're asking forgiveness from is a totally enlightened being and is sort of beyond reproach, or couldn't do anything harmful deliberately, still the ceremony recognizes, even the Buddha could upset people, could hurt people's feelings and make choices that were painful or difficult for others, that could be carried around and be resented. So that even though these little ceremonies are done over and over and the words are the same every time, then if they're held in a skillful way, if we are using them as forms without clinging to them, then they are capable of really bringing about a very beautiful transformation that changes the way that we see each other. It changes the way that we relate to the world, and so that that these rituals, like the puja, these ceremonies of asking for forgiveness, if we breathe life into them, if we take them into the heart in a skillful way, then they really bring about and help to support those qualities of letting go of the past, recognizing that our actions might have been hurtful to others, whether we intended it or not, and humbly recognizing that. Also, the things that we've been carrying around about others that we might resent or be irritated by, we're making a gesture to say, well, yes, there has been irritation, but I can get over it, I can let go of it, and this is life, that we irritate each other. And that we can acknowledge that painfulness, we can know it, we can digest it, we can let it go. We can recognize the fault, our own faults or the faults of others where they have been done, to see the painfulness that comes from that, and to let that painfulness be something that is a catalyst for our awakening, for our liberation. And that, in this way, miraculously, these simple rituals, these forms, these perceptions, even though they're empty and insubstantial, they can bring about real changes and a real awakening to that which is substantial, that which is valid, that which is not fake, which is the Dhamma itself. The reality of Nibbana. The Buddha once said in the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, Nibbana is equals the fifth noble truth, or the supreme noble truth. That this is the supreme noble truth is the actuality of Nibbana. And when we see things in this way, when we let go of our habitual perceptions, then that is. As he's talking, he's using the analogy of a goldsmith and purifying gold. He's saying, this is what is true, this is what is valid, this is what is of genuine worth, is Nibbana, the realization of Dhamma. This is that which has true validity and is truly reliable and substantial, the Dhamma itself. So I offer these words for consideration this evening. Whatever is useful, please take it and use it. Whatever is not, please leave aside. As per usual, back into the regular routine of the observance days for the year. The vigil will carry on till midnight, and we'll close the evening then with a little chanting and finish at that time. So those of you who are able to stay and take part in the vigil, you're more than welcome to do so. And those of you who need to go home or take a rest, then please feel very welcome to do that too.